It's the Mike Tech Show, show number 423. This show is a proud member of the Tech Podcast Network. If it's tech, it's here. Please visit techpodcast.com. Hello, everybody. Welcome to the podcast. I'm your host, Mike Smith. Thank you very much for downloading and subscribing to the show. Please visit the main website at miketechshow.com. You can email me questions and suggestions for future show topics. My email address is miketechshow@gmail.com. You can leave me a voicemail message. The phone number is 240-949-2450. And that's Mike Tech Show, all one word, on Skype. Follow me on Twitter, twitter.com/MikeTechShow. And you can follow me on Facebook. Leave me a friend request. The website, facebook.com/MikeTechShow. And don't forget the wiki, mtswiki.com. There you'll find links to all of the past shows. I have a great show in the sense that we're going to talk about one topic in the beginning, which I'm going to read the one email that spawned that, but I've gotten several emails asking me to talk about PCI compliance. Now, don't worry. I'm not going to go crazy technical on you with it. I'm going to describe it in the simplest way that I can that can help you possibly gain some more business and some work consulting or supporting small businesses that are challenged with this. And even if you're not consulting, maybe you know someone that takes credit cards. And this is the basics of what you'll need to know to go forward. And I'm going to give you that info. So you don't be scared of this. It's something that you, even without the training and the certification, as we break it down, you're going to be able to help them. Then I have lots of other email that we're going to get to. Time permitting, I do have some music queued up for the end of the show. Before we get into the PCI compliance, the past week I received some interesting support calls, but from other consultants who are listeners of the show and needed help. And one person who needed help with a brand new server that he was setting up for a client, and it was Active Directory, and he was getting some error messages, and he wanted to make sure that it was okay and everything was configured right before he delivered it to his client. So he contacted me, and I said, go to miketechshow.instanthousecall.com. And he went there and downloaded the little program to connect to a support specialist, which is me. I'm running the client at the other end. And it is so simple. When he requested support and just made one click, I seen that request. It popped right up on my screen. When I clicked OK, I was remote controlling his server. And I was able to go in and diagnose what was wrong with the DNS and what was wrong with all. There was only a couple things, but I had to make some critical, important changes that eliminated those errors. Then I had a test to make sure we can connect to the domain, and he had a test workstation, and I said, go to that workstation and log it, go back to the Instant House Call website, and he downloaded the program. It took only a couple seconds, clicked, and I was remote controlling both systems and was able to do the work connecting that system to the server, and we could see what was happening at the server, see at the workstation. That's why Instant House Call is the best remote control software that you can find with all the great tools that you need to be able to support friends, family, clients, anybody. Right now, you can receive and play with Instant House Call free for 15 days. Just go to instanthousecall.com and sign up and use the promo code MikeTechShow. So give that a try for 15 days, and I guarantee you, you're going to be back, and you're going to want more because the software just flat out works. And I already know it works with Windows 8 because that's what was on running on the client was Windows 8, where the consultant downloaded the client. In the same week, I had another client that had now a new client, a consultant listener who contacted me who needed help with an Exchange server problem, and I was able to help him. So a couple things here. Instant House Call is what I use to quickly remote support somebody, but also if you need help with a complicated issue and you want me to log in and help you, I can do that. And my rates are very reasonable for other consultants because I understand you got to make money. I want to make money. I'm very reasonable. I'll help you out. I'll do the best that I can. And then how I usually accept payment is, you know, we agree on a number and you'll go to PayPal and make a donation. And that's how I get paid remotely. It works out really, really good. And having the right tools to be able to do that is what it's all about. Let's talk about PCI compliance. First off, you've heard that term. What does it mean? What is PCI compliance? It's payment card industry. It doesn't stop there. The real acronym is PCI DSS. So PCI is payment card industry. It's the industry, it's the banks and everybody that allows you to take credit cards. And it's their data security standard. And it's a standard that's now been around for a couple years that guarantees, or they do the best they can, that you can secure the data that's being transmitted. You can secure that information that you're taking when you take a credit card. Give a listen to this email. It's from Michael. And he says, I've been listening to your show for almost a year now. Great show. Keep it up. I heard you talk about PCI compliance a few times on the show and was wondering if you would do a show or two on that topic going over some of the questions. I had a local business ask me to do some work for them to try to get them compliant, but I turned them down because I didn't feel comfortable doing the work. So it's with that in mind. Of what Michael asked, that I want to present to you some links that will help break down that fear of what PCI compliance is all about and what you can do and really, what is this? And the payment card industry had to come up with standards because of the different identity theft, you know, credit cards, you hear that they're being stolen from somebody, this information gets leaked out. And people can, and if someone can get a hold of your credit card information, game over. Boy, the identity theft, they'll be able to charge up a storm, and you hope that your bank will protect you enough that they'll see a pattern maybe that is not you and be able to maybe deny some of those charges. A lot of banks have where if you have something shipped to a different address that's different than your home location, they sometimes deny that. The banks try many, many things to put in place to help reduce the amount of identity theft, but it happens. And what you have to do as a merchant is be able to, as best you can, guarantee that the information you're taking is secured and protected. It's an information security standard for organizations that handle cardholder information for the major debit, credit, prepaid, e-purse, ATM, and point-of-sale cards. Defined by the Payment Card Industry Security Standards Council, the standard was created to increase controls around cardholder data to reduce credit card fraud via its exposure. Validation of compliance is done annually by an external qualified security assessor for organizations handling large volumes of transactions, or by a self-assessment questionnaire for companies handling smaller volumes. That's the key. If you are a merchant that's taken an incredible volume of credit cards, well, you don't get just to do a self-assessment. You're taking too many credit cards. You're taking in too much money and revenue. So you're going to be held to a higher standard where you may have an auditor that comes out to check that you're compliant. What we're talking about here are small businesses. Take credit cards occasionally, or, you know, enough, maybe a chiropractor or someone who does house inspections for a living, or someone that maybe does interior design, and they take credit cards. So a small business and their bank wants to make sure that they're following the standards. So what are the standards? It's very simple, and I'm going to have a links to this. One link I'm going to have to Wikipedia, which has that general definition, but I'm also going to have a quick user guide link to a PDF that will have all this information in it. And then I'm going to have a link to a website for a company that does scans against your network externally, against your IP address, to see if there are any holes opened up. And they test to make sure that your external, your connection to the internet is secured, or at least secured as it's defined by the payment card industry. So let's go over some of these standards here. There's goals, and then there's requirements to meet the goals. So here's one goal: to build and maintain a secure network. So if you're taking credit cards, you have to have a secure network, but that's pretty generic. So what does that mean? Install and maintain a firewall configuration to protect cardholder data. Well, that could be a simple router. So you don't have to go crazy here. You just got to have basic security in place. Do not use vendor supply defaults for system passwords and other security parameters. Wait a second. This sounds something like that Mike talked about, that I've talked about in the past, which is changing default passwords. There's a self-assessment form for small businesses that they have to answer every year. And you read the question and it says, are you changing default passwords? Yes. Make sure you're changing default passwords. You see how simple some of this is? It's things that we've talked about all along in the show. It's just that now they put a fancy name and a standard behind it. Small businesses have to follow this. Hey, if you have Wi-Fi, it's got to be protected. Use WPA2. That's all this stuff breaks down to. Let's read the second goal: to protect cardholder data. So how do we do that? Protect the stored cardholder data. Where is it being stored? Encrypt the transmission of cardholder data access, open and public networks. If you are taking a credit card using a service over the internet, you cannot have an open Wi-Fi on that same network. So here's what I do. If it's only one workstation that is taking the credit cards, I make sure that that one workstation has a separate router with no Wi-Fi on it, and it's connected back to the cable modem, or Fios modem, or whatever it is, or DSL, whatever the internet provider is, and I don't allow any other computers to be on that subnet. So what happens, just by the very scope of what we've defined, we've isolated machines that are taking credit card information to make sure it is absolutely secured, because now you have a transmission that's encrypted between that workstation and the service. So one of the things that's mentioned in this number two, making sure the data is encrypted, and you got to make sure you're not keeping all that information. You are not allowed to store an entire credit card with the name and with the expiration of that credit card in any database unless it is absolutely encrypted and those fields are encrypted. And if someone brings that information up in the database, they can't see it. So that's how this stuff drills down to some details. So if you're using a service that's outside, just make sure you're not keeping the entire credit card number. You're allowed to keep the last four digits. And some people don't even keep that. Why keep it if you don't need it? You're just going to use it for the time of the transaction and make sure, okay, it's either approved or not, and that's it. Here's the third one. Maintain a vulnerability management program. So use and regularly update antivirus software and programs. How easy is that? Develop and maintain secure systems and applications. You don't have to worry about that if you're using a third party to verify the credit card information. If you didn't write the program and you're not storing that information locally, that stuff's out of scope and you don't have to worry about it. So the key is, how are they taking the credit card and where are they storing it, if at all, if they're storing the information? Implementing strong access control measures. So that's the fourth goal. And you do this by restricting access to cardholder data by business need to know. If you have four employees, but only one really needs to process that information, the other three employees cannot have access to it. So that means there's got to be proper passwords, proper controls, proper employee instructions that make sure that they are not allowed to access that information. I'll go one step further. Make sure there's a procedure in place and a policy that they're not allowed to write down credit card information. Sometimes it's not a technical solution to being PCI compliant. It's a matter of having the right controls, the right procedures, the right policies that will keep you compliant. And you got to have those written down and make sure you discuss that with the employees or the person you're helping. Regularly monitor and test the networks. We're going to talk about this. Track and monitor all access to network resources and cardholder data. Regularly test security systems and processes. Now, this is where we come in as consultants. What you would want to do is you want to make sure that you are doing this annually. And here's what they will do. The credit card industry will make the company that takes the credit card have an annual scan done. And there's a company out there that very inexpensive, does a great job, and it's called TrustWave. And the small business owner can sign up with TrustWave, and this is an acceptable company that the credit card industry respects that you can have them do the scan. Now, I just helped out a client who is sitting inside a network of another company. Their scan for the one public IP address showed port 3389 open. Now, we know that that's the RDP port. Because that was open, they failed their compliance. And they had nothing even to do with the firewall. They're sitting behind a firewall where the IT person of another company, because they're renting space in there, that other company opened up that port. So there were two options. One, I have to get my client totally separated and isolated, which is what we're doing. Two, I had to have a conversation with the IT person who maintains that firewall and ask him to close that port so we could have another scan done by TrustWave so that they can pass the PCI compliance. We took care of that. And then the second step, so we never have to worry about them opening up a port that we don't have control over, I asked them for a public IP address and I ordered another router. And we're going to put the router. They only have two workstations. This is simple. We're going to make sure they're connected behind that router, and I'm going to follow all these other procedures. You got to make sure that the system has a password. It can't just log right in. The self-assessment is probably like 100 or so questions that you have to answer. And when you look at them and think about each question, it's pretty simple. Making sure system gets updated. Making sure antivirus. Now, a question in the chat. How do you trust a waiter or waitress who takes away your card? You're absolutely right. So for the restaurant to be PCI compliant, they have to have very strict procedures, or they should, or at least they said they do, that employees have to be trained. They are not allowed to do anything else with that card. They can't write it down. They can't make a copy of it. And they need to sign an employee handbook or that they've received. I mean, this is the right way to be PCI compliant. The employees have to be instructed that they go to that point of sale terminal, they swipe the card, and that's it. And those point of sale terminals have to be on a secured network that then goes back, and your information's not saved. It's just a one-time secure transaction that approves the sale of the food. And that's it. Is every restaurant doing that? I don't know. They're supposed to. The credit card industry's making them do a self-assessment. And then based on their volume, and if they're a real big chain, I would think that they have their own internal procedures, their own manuals, their own processes for controls. That's what it's all about, securing the information or making sure when that transaction happens that that is secured, nothing else can access it, even other people. If there's the possibility of another person accessing it, then you have to have these controls, procedures, a policy in place that the employees are being taught for how to properly handle a credit card. The last thing is maintain an information security policy. This is where everybody fails. I don't know any small business that has an information security policy. That can get complicated, but here's what it says. Maintain a policy that addresses information security for employees and contractors. So, if a contractor comes in like myself and is doing any work on that system, there should be a document that I sign that I agree that I'm not going to share any information that I see. I'm going to, you know, basically a confidentiality agreement should be in place with any contractor that's going to touch the computers, and especially computers that are taking and working with any kind of payment and a credit card. In that security information policy should be all contractors must sign the following agreement and agree to blah, 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 blah. Employees cannot write down numbers. So what you do is you look at the self-assessment questionnaire, and you look at those questions that can skew you to be not compliant. And some of those questions, you can say, yes, I will. It's okay. I am compliant here because I'm going to add this to my policy. And you basically can build a policy right from those questions, just by answering them and saying that you what you're agreeing to on that questionnaire, I'm going to do it. I'm going to write down that I'm doing it. And this is the proof. And this is the manual. So this way, if you did have an audit where someone would come in and look, you got the backup. Why is all this happening? It is because if you sign, or the small business signs that agreement saying that, or basically the self-assessment questionnaire, and you say, oh, yes, I'm secure, I'm doing all, and you're not, you're dead meat. If you ever have a credit card lost, or you could, your business could be shut down. The bank could say, you said you were compliant. You've went through all this. If you lied, you're done. You'll never be able to take a credit card again for your company. That could be devastating. It's the credit card industry protecting themselves by forcing the merchants to be compliant with these standards, because the merchants aren't going to do it themselves. Some do. So what you're doing is you're basically agreeing, or your client is agreeing, that you are going to follow these instructions and that you are going to be compliant. So now, as an IT consultant, as a contractor, what we do for support, guide your client first in answering and reviewing all these questions. Wait until you see how simple some of these questions are. Just by your very listening to this show over time, you're going to be able to answer almost all of these questions. It's just that it's put down and wrapped up pretty, and it's called PCI compliance. And that's it. It's common sense. It's saying, hey, I'm going to be updating the antivirus. I'm going to be doing blah, 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 blah. And when you say you do it, you back it up by doing it. And you help your client get there by doing it. If they don't have anything in place for doing automatic updates, you make sure they do. If they have an open Wi-Fi, lock it down. If they want a public Wi-Fi, have a separate router on a separate subnet, have it where it can't touch the regular network. If they have point-of-sale systems, you make sure that all the point-of-sale systems are on maybe a VLAN or their own router. This is where VLANs, which are virtual LANs, it's why I like using a smart switch at the back end, at the central point where all the wires and connections come into, because let's say they are a merchant, that they are taking credit cards with terminals. I can have those terminals isolated by literally in the switch saying these ports are all separate and they go out to the internet on a separate connection. No other computers. Nobody can touch them. It's basically isolating and then making sure you got policies and procedures wrapped around that isolation, that you're following all of the compliance questions in that self-assessment questionnaire. The next thing is to make sure that you pass that scan from TrustWave. Make sure that if you fail, they tell you very clearly why you failed. So if there's ports that open that you shouldn't have open, shut the ports down. And if you say, well, Mike, you needed those ports for remote access, guess what? You got to come up with another way for remote access, something like instant house call. There are answers to everything, and you got to make sure that your client is compliant. And you see how just by, I hope I broke it down simplistic enough that you would feel a little bit comfortable in helping a small business achieve PCI compliance. And that's what this show was all about tonight. I have some other email that I want to get to. This email is from Chad, and he says, Mike, thanks for your show. I've been listening since show 387. A friend at work told me about your podcast. Once I started listening, I haven't wanted to stop. I look forward to the show every week. Anyway, I just wanted to say thanks and that I appreciate the time you take to make the show. Thank you. And that's Chad. I really appreciate it. He's a systems engineer. Multiple internet connections. Hi. Are there, and this is Stanford, are there any problems or advantages of using two internet connections at the same time? I have a router and a wireless NIC card that I can use, and my PC is also hardwired to the same router. Thanks. You can't use the two connections from your computer like that, the wireless and the wired. You really should just use your wired connection if you have the choice. But if you have two internet connections with two providers coming in, see, you're trying to use two network connections back to your one internet provider. So there's a couple ways to answer this simple question. You really need, if you only have one internet provider, but you want to increase your bandwidth to the switch, it's not going to help your internet speed. Think of how fast your speed is coming down. If it's 20 meg, if you have a 1 gig card, you're already faster. Having a second network connection bound together is not going to help you. We can get real complicated real fast. If you want, let's say you have 2 gig NIC cards in your system and you want to bind them together, you got to have a switch at the other end that can handle that, that can bind those two ports to act as one and give you 2 gig bandwidth. You can do that. There are switches that will let you. That's only good if you got other computers that are on that same network that can handle 2 gig. So unless you're binding two other ports to maybe a server or something, now you can talk some really good bandwidth. So now let's get, I'm not sure, but the other part of this question possibly is if you have two separate internet connections coming in, you need an intelligent enough router that can have both those connections. And there's different ways you can bind them together. You can have it where it's a failover, where if one internet connection fails, it'll automatically fail over to the other, or you can bond the two together, and there's special routers that will do that. But they get very expensive very fast. I think your basic question is, hey, I got a wireless NIC and a wired NIC. Why can't I put them together? That's not going to help you get any faster internet connection unless you have an unbelievably fast connection. And even then, let's say you had a 300 meg down from the new Fios. That's still, if you have a gig NIC for your wired NIC card, having two is not going to make it any faster. Look at the speeds of everything and then think about this. I think you have your answer. So no, don't want to bind them. And you know what? You're not going to get anywhere, even if you could. It's a tip from Daniel. Mike, I really love your show, and I've been listening all the way back to show number one. When you share a contact with contacts, contacts makes a VCF file. This is a universal file. It works with any program where contacts are involved. Also, any program like Gmail, Thunderbird, or Outlook can make this file. A script should be able to sync with an Android. I think it would be a good idea to share with your listeners. At least once a week, I get a social engineering call from someone claiming to be in Microsoft support wanting to help with my PC. This is from Dan, and thank you very, very much. This is a tweet from Touchdown Tech, and I want to address it because it's too hard to answer over a tweet in Twitter. What's a solution for sharing Drobo over Hamachi? It seems that NAS devices can't be shared. Oh, yes, they can. I access them all the time. Is there a different VPN solution? No, you have the right solution. What you don't realize, and go back to Hamachi and download the docs. It's all based on the IP address that you're given on your private network. And you got to take the last digits of the IP address of the Drobo and change, instead of 192.168, let's say it's .1.100. If your network is 10.15.something, change it to .100 when you try to access it, and I bet you're going to be able to map back to that shared device. You have to, at the other end of the VPN connection, change the IP address. You can no longer use the internal IP address. They make that swap for you, and you can add the last octet to the IP address scheme that you've been given when you connect. And you're going to be able to access those shared devices. I do it all the time. This is about cloud services, and it is from Shad. I always use your Amazon link to make purchases to support your great cast. Ah, thank you very much. I learn more about supporting current technology from your podcast than any of the many other tech podcasts I listen to. I was listening to last week's show number 422, and you mentioned security concerns with using the cloud. I had listened to episode 50 of the cloudcast.net, and Phil Cox, the guest on the show, brought up a good point about security in the cloud. He said that executives get concerned about security in the cloud and neglect to consider their own network security has the same problems. The point is that if your network is attached to the internet, it is vulnerable. I think a bigger concern of storing data in the cloud are the legal issues. If the cloud servers are located in another country, the privacy laws are different, and your data may be considered public information. I know that Amazon's Elastic Cloud is divided into regions, which I believe gives you more control as to where your data is located, but I am not certain. Oracle is making a big push with its new Fusion products by hosting enterprise applications in the cloud. With Fusion, Oracle is trying to unite all of their various software solutions into one cloud-based platform. Fusion is still in beta form. Oracle has a very bad reputation with their current cloud services. I have heard customers complain about Oracle support staff isn't very responsive in fixing problems. Also, customers complain of the lack of control they have over their hosted applications. I was wondering if any of your listeners had tried installing PeopleSoft or QuickBooks Enterprise on a service like Microsoft's Azure, IBM's Smart Cloud, or Amazon's EC2. This seems a better solution because you have more control over the servers and the application. Thanks, Shad. I do have a client that is using Cloud9, and I believe that is really a Citrix solution. It is a full desktop in the cloud with a cloud-based server, and they have their enterprise QuickBooks on that, and they are an accounting company that they do tax returns for many, many, many clients. All of their workstations are cloud-based. So all they need is a good internet connection. That's it. So they can access that from anywhere in the world. They just need a browser with a good internet connection. It's secured, a great solution. And they like it. And it's not that expensive. I think it might be like 300 and some per seat per year. But when you add that up with the licensing of the Office products that they also provide, it could be worth looking at. As opposed to everything else, I have been out of the corporate world for 4 years, so I haven't been working with Oracle and PeopleSoft, although I used to, and there was no cloud services back then, 4 years ago, or at least ones that we would seriously consider using. Everything was still local server-based for our ERP system, and there was no thought of going to the cloud 4 years ago. So now I know things have changed, and I'm seeing slow acceptance of cloud services because of security and some of the concerns that you've mentioned. Yes, I completely agree with your statement that people have to look internally at their network security, and I bet you there's a lot of flaws. And you're possibly right, but there's a comfort with an Office that they can lock. And they, you know, they got their own physical based security that they feel comfortable with and they can control. When it's out there and you can't see it, touch it, smell it, there's a concern. And there are lots of companies and there's lots of executives that are having trouble with this. There's just going to be some people that are going to be very slow to really come on board with that. So we have to see. Some companies are going to be more aggressive than others. This email is from Pete, a longtime listener from down in New Orleans, Louisiana. He has an Amazon question. Will you still get credit if someone that has an Amazon account goes through your link and then logs into their account? Absolutely. As long as you get there from my link, I will get credit. Just wanted to make sure you get all the credit you can. Glad to use the link and tell others about it. Oh, thank you. And it might be worth a mention of how to add this link to your bookmarks. As I have done so, it is automatic. Thanks for all the great concerns. Waterlogged, but enjoying all the content. Pete, I'm so glad to hear from you with the past storms. Boy, waterlogged, you said it. I mean, you guys have suffered enough down there. I remember not hearing from Pete and was worried during Katrina, and I was really glad to receive an email after that. For longtime listeners, going way back to the early shows, do you remember there was an individual who was transcribing all of my shows into text? That's Pete. So I do remember. Pete, thank you for not only your dedication and support, just thank you so much, and I'm glad you're safe. I want to thank everybody for using my Amazon link, because if you go to and save this, amazon.mikenation.net, go there and bookmark that. Anytime you want to go to Amazon, just use that link and I get credit and it helps support the show. And I really, really, really appreciate that. Few final things. There was an update to FAB's auto backup for tech, and I received an email last night. So if you have bought it and are using FAB's Auto Backup for Tech, there's a few fixes, minor fixes. Download the latest version. Just wanted to make you aware. Something I subscribe to that I missed for, boy, I haven't read an issue for a while, and it's Maximum PC. Love that magazine. And it's available for the Kindle for just 99 cents a month. As a matter of fact, the first one is free. Talking about tablets and talking about, you know, how you view things and absorb content, the original black and white Kindle magazines are, to me, are worthless. It's horrible. You can't really read the content properly. But in color, with the Kindle app on the iPad, Maximum PC looks wonderful. And I was able to breeze through the whole October issue. Lots of great stuff. So I still give a big thumbs up to Maximum PC if you're a real geek and you like geeking out with the different tips and the different hardware. And it kind of gets me back involved in some of the hardware because I kind of lose touch with what's happening with processors and graphics cards and some of the neat toys out there. And it was nice just going through that to try to stay on top of some of that, of what's happening. So check that out. It's pretty inexpensive. And if you have an iPad or a 7-inch Kindle Fire or even your 7-inch, some of your Android devices that have color, look for the Kindle app and try the free issue of Maximum PC and let me know what you think. If I think it's great, at least you can try it out. And if it doesn't look right, you don't like it, you're not committed to buying it every month. So you get that first issue free. So that's pretty neat. Next, PAX, the Philadelphia Area Computer Society. They take off for 2 months for the summer. We're back starting up in September 15th. And I'll have a link to the PAX website. I will be doing a presentation. Again, I'm still the SIG leader for the Windows Tips and Tricks SIG. And the topic for September will be troubleshooting and solving your everyday Windows problems. So I'm going to have some great troubleshooting tips and tricks during that session. So if you're in the area, please come down and check out PAX, and that's the Philadelphia Area Computer Society. That is it for tonight. I do have some music, and I was just watching this group on, I think, the channel Padilla for a concert from a couple years ago, and it was great, and it made me think this is a very popular song that the Foo Fighters have called Everlong. And I really like it, but you're used to the fast version. And I might have played this a long time ago. I'm not sure, but I came across this in my library. And this is the acoustic version of Everlong. Give a listen. Thank you.
breathe out so I can breathe you in. Hold you in. And now I know you've always been out of your head, out of my head, I say. And I wonder when I sing along with you, everything could ever feel this real forever. If anything could ever be this good again. The only thing I'll ever ask of you, you gotta promise not to stop when I say it. When she sang, feel this real forever. If anything could ever be this good again. The only thing I'll ever ask of you, you gotta promise not to stop when I say when.
That is the acoustic version of Everlong by the Foo Fighters. Love that. Love acoustic versions. So I try to work them in at the end of the show when I can. I'll have a link to where you can buy the, actually you can get the MP3s or the CD from Amazon, and I'll have a link, their greatest hits, which contains that acoustic version. So I want to thank everybody for downloading and subscribing to the show, and for sharing my Amazon link, and hey, visit Instant House Call to get your free trial. I really appreciate it and all your support. Thank you so much. And I will talk to you next week, same time, same channel. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to The Mike Tech Show, a proud member of the Tech Podcast Network. Please visit techpodcast.com.